You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, BC. This radio is diverse, independent, and always yours. Check us out at cjsf.ca or search CJSF 90.1 FM on SoundCloud.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
There are some whose major influence was the 60s. Some who went from protest of the Vietnam War, used psychedelics, marched for civil rights, traveled to India and found a guru, and then went on to make a positive contribution to the world community. Dr. Larry Brilliant is such a person. Today we'll be exploring how, at the behest of his Indian guru, Larry was inspired to join the World Health Organization to launch a program to eradicate smallpox in India. And this story of smallpox eradication is but one proof that something can be done, that little by little, we can make this planet a place with less suffering. Although we are finite beings, we can still create a world with infinitely more love, more joy, and less pain. Larry's story will take us on a trip from being a radical young hippie doctor from Detroit to being inspired by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. into becoming an activist for civil rights and also protesting the Vietnam War, joining his friends from the Hog Farm Commune when he traveled by bus from London over the Khyber Pass with his wife, Girija, at the most unlikely place, Neem Karoli Baba's ashram in the Himalayas. Many of us remember that name as the one written about in Ram Dass's seminal book, Be Here Now. Larry Brilliant is a pioneering physician, visionary technologist, and global philanthropist. He was the first executive director of Google.org, and he currently serves as chair of the Skoll Global Threats Fund. He co-founded the SAVA Foundation, whose programs and partners have restored sight to more than 4 million blind people in dozens of countries. He co-founded one of the first digital social networks, The Well, and he's the author of the memoir, Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. Join us for the next hour as we explore an insider's account of a changing of an age with our guest, Dr. Larry Brilliant. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Larry, welcome.
Thank you, Justine. Thank you very much for having me.
It's my pleasure. I think of your life rather like Jack and the Beanstalk. It's like the Beanstalk. You started your India adventure in the most unlikely of places. You started it with assisting a birth on Alcatraz Island in the San Francisco Bay Area. Can you tell us about that beginning?
Sure. I just wonder who the giant is.
Right. We're still looking for that.
Yeah. Well, in the mid-60s, the radical movement that was the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, became a movement for women's rights and latterly for gay and lesbian rights. That movement had spread to medicine. And there were a group of us who were called radical doctors. And we marched with Martin Luther King, and we all wore our white lab coats with our stethoscope ostentatiously dangling from the side. And I was part of that group. And a number of us decided that we would do our internship in the same city. I think probably if we had been more committed and less in desire of comfort, we would have done that in Trenton, New Jersey, but we decided to do that in San Francisco. So I showed up in San Francisco just about during the summer of love. And my internship was at Presbyterian Hospital. It's now California Pacific. And when I was finishing my internship, a group of Native Americans took over Alcatraz. And took over is probably even the wrong word. According to the Treaty of Laramie, any land which had been seized from Native Americans by the federal government, upon it being declared no longer needed or surplus, it reverted back to the ownership of the Native Americans. That was the treaty that we signed, but we broke it, as we broke so many treaties with Native Americans. And that treaty covered Alcatraz. It should have been returned to its owners per that treaty. And a group of Native Americans thought that Alcatraz would be a fitting symbol of years of Native American history. And they were going to put an educational center on and make it a welcoming place for people. But the federal government didn't like that. So they decided that instead they would come at night and take over Alcatraz. And that was the takeover of Alcatraz by the Indians of all tribes. And that group had been there for about 8 or 9 months when a woman named Lou Trudell was 9 months pregnant, and the Coast Guard tried to evacuate her off of the island, and she insisted that she would give birth to her baby on Indian liberated land. A columnist at the time, Herb Kane, began to write almost every other day, there's no water, there's no electricity, there's no medicine, there's no doctor. Is there no doctor who will get off his ass and go live on Alcatraz and help deliver that baby? And, of course, that to me seemed like an advertisement. Larry, please come to Alcatraz. So I went to Alcatraz, and I stayed on the island for about 3 or 4 weeks until Lou delivered her baby. And it was a magical time. She gave birth to a boy. She named him Wovoka. And Wovoka, the original Wovoka, had lived 200 years earlier and had created the Ghost Dance religion. Sitting Bull, Geronimo, had become followers, and he prophesied that he would, after he died, that he would sort of go into orbit around the world, around the earth, and then he would be reincarnated again. And when he did, the Indian way would return, the buffalo would return. And so by naming this boy Wovoka, I can feel the chills even now, that was a magical moment on that island and a meaningful time for all of the Native American community. I guess to bring it up to full modernity, yesterday I got an email from Wovoka, and we're Facebook friends. And he's now about 6'4". He's an artist living in Los Angeles and just a wonderful kid.
That's wonderful. And that put you in touch then with a group of people who lived in something called the Hog Farm Commune, Wavy Gravy being one of the main characters in that. And you all then got together somehow, and there's a lot of this story, and I just encourage people to pick up the book. Sometimes Brilliant is the name of the book, the memoir, and you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll really get into it. But that, through a series of events, you ended up in a hippie bus, so to speak. You're doing a concert in near London, and you're taking this bus and you're driving overland all the way to India to deliver some medicines. And then I'm going to really get us up. Again, I say that there's a long story of all of this in the book, but you end up in a most unlikely place. You end up in an ashram in the Himalayas in northern India. And that was a very unlikely place for you at the time. So talk about that early arrival, and what was your state of being at that point?
Well, I mean, I know that transformation sounds unusual today, but actually going from being a radical to being a hippie to living in an ashram, that was the usual career path in the 60s.
That's right. Many people did it. Many people did it unsuccessfully, and many people did it successfully. So that's the point that I really want to make, because you did it successfully. And there are a lot of people that have done it that don't get credit for that. And I just wanted to mention that.
Oh, I think that culture has influenced the country in some wonderful ways. And it is a culture, you're right, that is coming of age and is, you know, and maybe even has already come of age and into power and into, you know, some presidents of universities, and many of the heads of philanthropies are from that culture. It was like walking into this wonderful recording studio and seeing my friend Jerry Garcia and all the memorabilia of that time. There are places in the world that have been so touched by that. You know, we used to say that you're either on the bus or you're off the bus. That was a Ken Kesey quote. And I think by that it means not literally you're either on the bus or you're off the bus, but either part of that culture or you're not. A high percentage of young people of that time were on the bus, either physically or metaphysically. And that bus trip, which was after Canterbury, a Pink Floyd concert that was part of a Warner Brothers movie, we traveled through Afghanistan and Turkey and Iraq and Iran and Pakistan. And I just have to say that wherever we would go, we had two buses, 40 young people living on these two buses. Wherever we would go, I think we looked like Martians. As we would pull up into this small village, Wavy would get out. Wavy, who's been my best friend now for 40 years, he would get out in a clown's outfit, and he would have bubbles to blow and toys to give away. And I would go out and I would play the doctor. And my medical equipment would come out, and I'd set up a little clinic. And we'd go into tiny little villages in Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan. And if it was a Muslim village, in the center of that village, there would be an altar but a picture of Mecca. If it was a Buddhist village, in the center of that village would be an idol or an image or a statue of Buddha. Hindu, a picture of Vishnu or Shiva. Christian, you can understand. And not all the time, but maybe 2 out of 10 times or 3 out of 10 times, right next to that image of Buddha or Jesus or Mecca or Vishnu, in the holiest part of the center of the village, right next to that, there'd be a picture of John F. Kennedy.
Wow. We're going to hear more about this story in just one moment. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. Larry Brilliant. He's the author of Sometimes Brilliant, An Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. And if you want to know more about the work of Larry Brilliant, you can go to his website, larrybrilliant.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Dr. Larry Brilliant. He's the author of a memoir, Sometimes Brilliant. And Larry, you were just talking about this overland trip that you were taking to India and about all the different religions that were represented in each of these small villages. But also there was this picture of John F. Kennedy.
Now, Hermann Hesse had written this book, Journey to the East, and it was sort of the organizing principle for this trip. We would go from England all the way to Kathmandu, as it would turn out, but we would stop at every church or mosque or temple or pilgrimage site, Buddhist vihar. And we were as curious as you could be about all these different traditions. And it was a surprise that in these little villages right next to the holiest of holy, we would so often see a picture of John F. Kennedy. And it makes you think of what America meant in the world in those days. Aspirationally, we certainly had Vietnam. We had Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We had Japanese internment camps. We had the civil rights struggle. Not that we were by any means perfect, but we represented something for people in the poorest and most destitute parts of the world, almost like a friendly rich uncle. It's going to be a long time before there's a picture of another American president on those altars in those places, in those tiny villages. And my kids can't make that trip. Your kids can't make that trip today. The only way you could go to Afghanistan or Iraq is as a soldier, not as a pilgrim, as we went there. And I'm sorry about that, because that pilgrimage was the defining point of my life.
So now you ended up in this ashram with this guru known as Neem Karoli Baba, who, as I mentioned in my introduction, many of us had heard that name through various ways. One of the main ways Ram Dass wrote about him in Be Here Now in his seminal book. And so when you were there, I know that your wife was very devoted to him, it seemed right off, very soon after meeting him. You were not so devoted. It wasn't as easy for you. Am I correct in that?
I think it's fair to say that my wife, Girija, has always been smarter than me and almost always ahead of me. And she had gone to see Neem Karoli Baba. We called him Maharaji. And she had gone to see him when Wavy got sick, and I took him back to the United States to go to the hospital for treatment. Girija stayed behind in India and went to Buddhist meditation camps and went to different ashrams. And when she got to the ashram of Neem Karoli Baba and met Ram Dass and all these other amazing characters, many of whom we used to call the Das brothers, because it was Ram Dass and Krishna Das and Raghu, everybody. I was back in the United States with Wavy, and she was writing me and sending telegrams. It was very hard to talk on the phone in those days. You had to almost book a call 3 days in advance. And I remember distinctly that I had gotten to my mother's house in Cleveland, Ohio, with these two psychedelic painted buses and Wavy Gravy. And we were in her apartment in Mayfield Heights, Ohio. And a telegram came from my wife, and it said, living with Ram Dass and Maharaji, and my mother came in, and I was with Wavy, and she said, your wife has left you. She's living with this other man. And Girish and I had a lot of phone calls that were interrupted by a war that was going on between India and Pakistan and by technological issues. Really hard.
Yeah, you're talking about the early 70s.
Oh, there were no mobile phones. There were nobody had phones in their houses
in
India.
No such thing as the internet.
No. Yeah. No. But what Girish just said is, I won't come home. You come here. And we negotiated for about 3 months until Maharaji had said it was getting too dangerous in India because Pakistan was bombing India and near the Taj Mahal, where one of his ashrams were. And so he said all the Westerners had got to go home, and he told Girija, go bring the doctor, which was me. But he didn't say that to me. He said to her, go back and get him. So she said she would come back to the United States if I promised that after we paid off our debts and settled our affairs and got rid of our apartment in San Francisco, that I would come back with her to meet Maharaji. And I did it. And I tried. I mean, the first day I walked into the ashram, there were all these idols and everybody was bowing down to them and they were touching this guru's feet. And that didn't exactly fit with my Jewish background. And it was a weird setup. As I looked at it, I thought that my wife had been kind of seized by a cult. And exactly. I thought maybe I needed to find out where the local deprogrammer was. But of course, it turned out differently. After I had some difficult moments and told her that I was going to leave, and I told her one day that I was not feeling well, and that was really true. I was heartsick. And I went out on a lake near the ashram, Nainital Lake. And I was trying to find, I was so depressed because leaving this guru would mean leaving my wife. I knew that she wasn't going to leave him. And I started to pray. And I think it was the first time in my adult life that I had actually prayed. I didn't know how, but I prayed. I asked for a sign and I was struggling with God. I said, it doesn't have to be a big rainbow in the sky. Just a little rainbow and an oil slick on the water would be enough, but nothing. And that night I told Girija that I was going to leave. And we separated our belongings into two orange backpacks. And the next morning, I mean, we were crying and hugging each other and crying and hugging each other. She said, you're going to leave, but will you at least come and say goodbye to him? And I said, sure, I grew up in the Midwest. I mean,
it's the polite thing to do.
It's the polite thing to do. I'm not going to stay. So we got a taxi, which drove us to the ashram. I told the taxi driver to wait with my backpack in the taxi because I thought this was going to be a very brief goodbye. And we got there just early enough that we had the first seats in front of the bed that Maharaji sat on, a tucket, actually, it was called. And the villagers had taken apples and flowers and arranged them on the bed in what's called a mandala. And they had made the apples so that they formed the name of God, Ram, R-A-M, but in Sanskrit, in Devanagari. And one of the apples had fallen off onto the ground. And in my tradition at the time, it was wrong that the name of God should be incomplete. So I bent down to pick up the apple, thinking that I would put it and complete the mandala and return the name of God to its wholeness. And as I reached on to get the apple, the doors burst open and Maharaji, like an opera singer arriving on the stage, leaped out and saw me with my hand on the ground and immediately stepped on my hand. And so here I am doing the thing that I wanted to do least in the world, which was to touch an old Indian's foot.
What?
And he pinned me down with his foot. I thought he weighed 1,000 pounds. I couldn't get it out. I couldn't get my hand out from his foot. And he was looking at me and he was laughing and laughing. And I didn't think it was so funny. I mean,
it probably hurt.
Very awkward situation. And he's laughing and laughing and laughing. And then he says, in Hindi, because we spoke Hindi, we studied Hindi in San Francisco to be able to understand him. And he said, you were not here yesterday. And I'm thinking, oh, at least thank God he noticed that, because he hadn't said a word to me. And I was feeling I didn't belong there. And then he said, where were you yesterday? And he began this series of inquiries, which seemed rather usual. Where, you know, were you out horseback riding? And then he looked at me and started laughing. He said, were you talking to God? And then he did this thing that he would do, pretending to be a fortune teller, put his hand by his head and looked up into the stars. And he said, did you ask for a sign? And when he said that, my back lit up like a Christmas tree and my fingers tingled and I got lightheaded and everything changed. The world seemed to be all tingly, and I looked up at him and he was just looking up into the sky, and I could see that it seemed to me that he loved everybody, and he looked at me with such compassion, and he reached down and started playing with my beard and pulling it, and I could just feel so much love. I'd never felt that kind of love before. And then, you know, my mind was kind of racing, and the scientist in me was saying, well, it's okay that he loves everybody in the world. That's his job description. He's a guru. And then I suddenly started to love everybody in the world. And I was almost saying to myself, oh, this is not right. This body was not made to love everybody in the world. What's going on here? Am I having a heart attack? My heart seems very warm. And he wouldn't release me. And then he looked at me and I felt like I was home. And then he pulled my beard. He said it, slapping my cheek. And he said, Dr. America, you're Dr. America. As if he had just given me a name. And as soon as he did that, all the other Das brothers who were around, who had been kind of hanging out in the back to see how this thing would go, and all the ashram women, they all came and circled me and hugged me. And that was my initiation. And I had read in all the old Indian texts about the guru's initiation. I thought that there was some bit of Sanskrit that you would read and recite and get a grade on or something like that. But this was my initiation into the community of people who were searching for God, who were trying to understand what God means and what life means. And we began on a daily basis, well, they had already for years on a daily basis been reading the Bhagavad Gita, the Ramayana, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Dhammapada, the Buddhist holy books, the books from Taoism and Islam, the Quran we were reading, everything, trying to read all the great religions. And Maharaji would every day have what was called a darshan. It's almost the same word as an audience when you think of the Pope giving an audience, except darshan means vision, audience means hearing. And he would ask questions. He would have us read passages from the books that we had been reading. He would tell us aphorisms. He would mostly joke and make us laugh and give us tea and sweets. And we called the secret teachings that he gave us the secret lessons. We call it the five-limbed yoga. And it was love, drinking tea, eating sweets, dancing around and gossiping. And it was such a joyous time.
Wow. That's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that beautiful. It's like a transmission that he gave, I think some might call it. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. Larry Brilliant, and he's the author of a memoir, among many other accomplishments, but he's the author of a memoir, Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our